Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN in association with Betfred. Wildcard weekend, which means only one thing, our wildcard weekend preview. Actually, I stand corrected, gang. It is super wildcard weekend, of course, which means we are doubling down. Tom Deacon back in the house in a little bit, helping us get set for some of the big games this weekend. We're going to kick things off, though, with ESPN insider Jeremy Fowler. Talk about some of the big matchups with him, but also some of the big stories around the NFL, including the new GM in Houston, the coaching carousel, who might land where, all the inside stories. Coming up first with Jeremy Fowler. Jeremy, great to see you again. Happy New Year. A lot of stuff I want to get into. We're going to look at a couple of the wildcard games, but some news I want to talk to you about, first of all. I'll start kind of joining the two right off the bat, and the Cleveland situation, the COVID situation there, because obviously it's a significant disadvantage with Stefanski out. But is there any danger that if there are any more COVID positive tests that the game will get moved?
Well, Nat, great to be with you. And yeah, there's always the danger of that. They're monitoring that daily. So yesterday, their test results were good. No new positives. And then today, they're hoping for the same. So as far as I've been told, there's no expectation of an outbreak right now. But unfortunately, you had, you know, four or five people come down with a positive, including the head coach and Joel Bitonio, who's a Pro Bowl guard, who was among those losing Browns teams that were winning zero or one games during the year. He's kind of like the sentimental part of the team now, because he finally made the playoffs. So he's out. So it's a difficult situation for a team that hasn't been in the playoffs in 18 years. And this is their moment to shine. And they're going to have their head coach really just watching from home, helpless. I mean, he cannot be involved in the game plan once it starts. He can only do things leading up to the game from home.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll break down the game in a bit. That is interesting to see and to monitor. Another big story coming out this week, of course, is the new GM of the Texans, Nick Caserio, 6-year deal, which makes him one of the top three paid general managers in the league. You joining the dots with the Deshaun Watson tweet that went out saying some things never change. Some people, conspiracy theorists, are putting those two things together. I mean, surely they can't be connected, right? I mean, Caserio's an incredible heritage. He's been involved in the Patriots and their success for so long. I mean, it surely can only be viewed as a positive, right?
Well, you would think so. I'm trying to kind of find out what that cryptic tweet means. There is some connection to Jack Easterby, who is an official with the team, who, you know, is like a former, it was in a former pastoral role in college, worked his way up through the Patriots as kind of like a do-it-all specialist, but never was really like a personnel general manager type. And then he got to Houston and has had a lot of influence. And there have been some reports that maybe some of that influence was not so positive. And so I think with Caserio coming on, it has nothing to do with his pedigree. It's a very good hire for them. But if that does align him with Jack Easterby, and that Easterby essentially won the power struggle in that building, that could be what he's referring to. I have not confirmed that, though. But, you know, there's been some turmoil there as a result of Easterby's presence, and that's hard to deny. So it could be some factors in play there. But, you know, Deshaun Watson's under contract on one of the biggest deals in the NFL for a long time. And so, you know, they're going to make it work with him and make him happy.
Yeah, that is interesting, because you'd imagine he's not going anywhere. But I mean, if this story does develop and it's clear that things are not as they should be, it's, in terms of power struggles, I mean, Watson would win that every time, right? Even against someone like Easterby, wouldn't it? They'd always back him if it came to it.
Yeah, if it came to it, certainly. But it's sometimes the player only has so much of an influence, you know. It's different in the NFL where, yeah, I guess he could request a trade if it really got to that, but nobody really thinks Deshaun Watson wants to do that. I think he wants to make it work in Houston, but it's not like in Houston with James Harden in the NBA, where you can kind of muscle your way into a trade and it's probably going to happen. It's just, it's a little different with the NFL. You know, franchise quarterbacks typically stay where they are. You know, that said, I think Caserio, with his pedigree, will be a very good influence in that building, especially if they get the right coach. I don't get the sense that Eric Bieniemy is headed to Houston right now, you know, the Chiefs offensive coordinator. And that was really the dot that a lot of people were connecting around the league. They thought he would be a favorite in Houston. And I think Watson wanted that. So that's a factor here as well. Maybe he's not getting his guy.
Yeah, well, speaking of franchise quarterbacks, looks like the Finns are sticking with Tua. That's the official line. In case that was in any doubt, I mean, you had this ridiculous overreaction to the Week 17 loss and a bad performance from Tua in difficult circumstances. But the Dolphins are saying he's our guy going forwards, but he's going to have a new offensive coordinator to work with. Chan Gailey has gone after just a year, resigned. Jeremy, did he jump before he was pushed? Is that the general perspective?
I think so. There could have been a mutual parting. I think if it went really well, he wouldn't have resigned. But he also came on. You know, he's older. He's in his 60s. I mean, there is a feeling that this could be a one-year experiment and just see how it goes. This wasn't necessarily viewed as a long-term thing. It was viewed as Gailey's a guy that Coach Brian Flores really respected. Wanted to try it out. He thought it'd be good for whether it's Ryan Fitzpatrick or a young quarterback. And it largely did work despite the end of the year struggles. And, you know, their quarterback picture is fascinating because it was an overreaction to say they're moving on from Tua. I don't think they are, but you have a third pick in the draft in a very good quarterback class. So if you have one staring you in the face, they at the very least have to do a lot of homework on those guys and determine and weigh the pros and cons of starting Tua in 2021.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to see how that plays out, because whilst I say it's an overreaction, he certainly hasn't given us enough of a body of work to be sure that he is a lock as their franchise quarterback going forwards. Interesting fallout from the Philadelphia situation. Everybody seemingly completely piling on to Doug Peterson. And I was interested to read Jason Kelsey's comments, and particularly in an Instagram post that he put out there, saying and maybe coming to the aid of, well, definitely coming to the aid of his head coach, but, you know, maybe putting the alternative argument forward, which is not necessarily a popular view but deserves a hearing, that the plan was always to bring in Nate Sudfeld, and he's a vet on the team. He's always been there, you know, 3-4 years. It's week 17. There's nothing in the game for Philly. Why shouldn't these players get a chance to show what they can do? And I have some sympathy with that argument, even if I think it's in the context of that particular game and where the game was, it's a little far-fetched. What happens to Doug Peterson? Does he weather this storm, do you think, ultimately?
Yeah, well, that's been the expectation. Just talking to people around the league, they do expect Doug to survive. But even last night, there wasn't full clarity on that yet. The owner has met, is my understanding. I think he's met with Doug Peterson already, you know, in their postseason meetings. But nothing has been fully crystallized. I mean, the owner needs to come out and say it. And I don't think that's happened yet. You know, they're probably sorting through maybe some potential staff changes. And so that becomes quite the process, but this was always going to drag on a little bit. It wasn't going to be like a Monday firing. I still expect him to stay, but you know, there's some moving parts, especially trying to wade through the mess of Sunday night, where you're right, Doug Peterson had made clear during the week and said publicly that he was going to play Nate Sudfeld, or wanted to at least. So it wasn't that much of a shock. It was just all the factors of a Sunday night game with the Giants needing them to get into the playoffs, and the fact that it was a 3-point game, you had a chance to win it. It just was very odd to put him in at that time.
Is that patronizing? I mean, I'm just playing this counter argument. This story does fascinate me. Is it patronizing to Nate Sudfeld, given that Jalen Hurts wasn't playing particularly well? I mean, I know he was offering them, he scored and was offering them, I guess, different dimensions, but with his arm, he wasn't playing particularly well. Is it really patronizing to a player like Nate Sudfeld? And we often malign backups or overlook them, guys that were, to the most part, stars in college that, for whatever reason, situation, or they just don't quite have the X factor, they're not starters in the NFL. But these are top elite athletes that we're talking about here. Is it a little bit patronizing to say, well, we don't have a chance now because we're bringing in Nate Sudfeld?
The short answer is yes. But I don't know what they were going to see in Nate Sudfeld in a quarter of play. That's the thing. You might as well have just started him in the game.
Right.
I don't know what you got out of one fourth quarter coming in cold when the offensive line was clearly not prepared for that. That was the issue. Mm. Even though Doug Peterson had said it wasn't a total shock, by Kelsey's post, it was clear that the offensive line had to adjust and was a little surprised. And so that probably played into a little bit of his struggles with the ball and fumbling and some of those things. So, you know, organizationally, Peterson could have got everybody a little bit more ready for that situation. And then, of course, you know, there's a speculation about whether they're just trying to get the better draft pick. Nobody's ever going to say that publicly or privately. But that's always going to be out there because they moved up three spots. And if you're able to trade Carson Wentz, or if they decide to do that, that's a smart thing. Those three spots make a huge difference in a potential quarterback. This is a very good class and among those top three to four guys. So that's probably too much for the Eagles to ignore.
Do you think that just bringing this to this conversation to a close in terms of the Philly situation, do you think that in many respects, it obviously is not lost on the ownership? They see the clear advantage and long-term advantage of that draft capital and gain. And as a result, it's not going to be the decisive factor on whether they keep Peterson or not. Or is that going to be offset by the pretty much uniform vitriol and embarrassment that has been caused by the decision, the situation? And that might end up being too overbearing and too insurmountable for Peterson to get past.
And I don't think they weighed all that thoroughly enough. Now, look, I'm not saying they tanked the game, but I'm saying if draft positioning went into any thought process during the week, that whole process is very nuanced. We saw it with the Miami Dolphins last year. Everybody thought they were tanking. They ended up winning five games, but they had given up a ton of players for a ton of draft picks. And so, you can't go out there with players you're paying a lot of money to and say, hey, we're going to try to massage the game. It doesn't work that way. But you can create scenarios like putting Nate Sudfeld in the game in the fourth quarter randomly when not everybody knows about it. And so there's no way to really do it if you want to compromise the game. You put everybody from the head coach to the players in a difficult spot, and you're in a market like Philadelphia, which is ravenous. You know, they want answers all the time. It's a beautiful market for that reason. But it's probably easier to do that in Miami than it is in Philly. We're seeing that right now. Even just on a surface level, just from a coaching standpoint, if you want to play a Nate Sudfeld, I don't know if they thought all the factors through that it was going to be this much of a backlash.
Yeah, right. Just quickly on the coaching carousel, because you referenced, of course, the situation in Houston and mentioned Eric Bieniemy's name. Just want to get a sense when you look at the vacancies, obviously Jacksonville, the Jets with Adam Gase, unsurprisingly gone, Detroit and Atlanta, we've known for a while, as with Houston. So some pretty interesting opportunities. I'm keen to understand what you think are the most enticing. And alongside Bieniemy, I'm hearing Arthur Smith's name getting talked up, Joe Brady as well, which is interesting considering he's only been in the NFL for 5 minutes. So who are the coordinators that are in the front line for landing a spot? And what do you think of the different opportunities? Which ones are the most attractive, do you think?
Yeah, so as far as candidates, I mean, I'm hearing a lot about Robert Saleh, the 49ers coordinator in Detroit. I think that's one they're going to at least think long and hard about. I wouldn't call him a favorite yet. It's still a little too early, but if I had to pick one, he would be the favorite right now. I do think Eric Bieniemy gets one of the jobs. He's interviewed for five of them already. Houston's the only one. And so we're going to see. This is a good week for Bieniemy for a team to just hire him now, because most coaches have to wait till next week to interview if they're in the playoffs, in the wild card, where Bieniemy has the bye, doesn't have to worry about that. He's in a better position. So it's probably good to try to take advantage of that now. So if he gets one by the end of the week, it wouldn't surprise, especially with the league really wanting a minority hire, needing a minority hire this year for good reason.
Yeah.
Joe Brady is, there's some momentum there. I don't think he's a major factor for all the jobs he interviewed for, but I think Atlanta, from what I'm hearing, he did well in the interview and he thinks he has a chance at that one. So that's going to be interesting to watch. A young guy whose offense didn't light the world on fire this year.
Right.
He's ranked in the bottom half of the league, but he's one of those, he's known as kind of a football brainiac. He's very smart. You put him in a room like that, talk football, he can impress the right people. Jacksonville is considered largely the best job despite their issues in the past. It's a complete clean slate. Whoever goes in there can just dig in, get a 7-year contract and change the culture and just have time to do it. I mean, really, I think that's why it's coveted, where the Chargers job, because of Justin Herbert, because of the pieces, a good general manager in place there, that's probably number one or two. The problem is the Chargers are, fair or not, have sort of been viewed the Cincinnati Bengals of the West, just kind of perpetually 500 or maybe not all that great and don't spend a whole lot. you know, they're just, they've never gone above and beyond to be the absolute best. It's just never happened for them. So, you know, I think culturally, is that a concern for a new head coach going in there?
Yeah, it's fascinating. The Jacksonville, worth pointing out, the Trevor Lawrence, in case it was in any doubt, there were some rumors that he might not come out in the draft, but he's announced that he's definitely going to do that. So obviously that's a lock. I'm hearing the name Urban Meyer with connected with Jacksonville. Is there any mileage in that?
Yeah, there is. It's growing. I'll put it that way. I mean, there's a lot of people around the league are expecting that right now. It just depends on, you know, it depends on whether this is just something Urban Meyer is flirting with or if he's all in, you know, because he has a relationship with the owner, Shad Khan. And then I think if all parties want to make it happen, you know, it's on the table for him. It just depends on whether he wants to wait out a college job, like a, you know, like a Notre Dame or a job he's always wanted on that side. He's a great recruiter. So that's probably his biggest strength. You know, do you put him back in college? So I think that's the decision he'll have to weigh. But he would have to be the favorite right now based on kind of the buzz around the league.
Why do you think, just a final point on that, because you got me thinking as you were talking about recruitment and the fundamental differences in terms of skill set between an NFL head coach and a college head coach. Why do you think Nick Saban has never come back to the league? Is it because he's on such a good gig with Alabama lucratively in terms of dominance? Is it more than that? Is there a sense that the right opportunity hasn't come up? Do NFL owners ever consider him, or is it quite clear that he's never coming back?
It's pretty clear that with Nick Saban in Alabama and to a lesser extent Dabo Swinney in Clemson, when you get it rolling, you can almost treat it like a college basketball job. If you're sort of a legend in your spot, you can coach there forever. And so he's got, you know, he makes $10 million a year, whatever it is. And, you know, every year they're loaded and they're better than they've ever been right now. And so, like, you know, when you have it like that and you know that your recruiting pipeline is so good and you're always going to be, you know, at worst 10-2, you know, it's hard to leave that. Why would you leave that? And Urban Meyer should have had that at Ohio State. You know, had some factors of what happened, you know, with the assistant coach and the scandal involved there and his role in that. And, you know, it changed the dynamic. But, you know, as long as you know that you can stay clear of any sort of off-field issues and just keep the ball rolling with recruiting and winning, then college can be a great job. It's just not that for most. Like, I'm hearing more than ever, more college coaches are trying to go to the NFL because they're sick of not only the recruiting, but you know, transfer rules and, you know, college football didn't handle COVID as well as the NFL did.
Right.
Just factors like that are making it a more difficult job. You know, the NFL seems fun to just go and be able to coach. But you know, if you're Nick Saban or one of those top guys, it's probably the best job in the world. You know, it's easier to win there than it is in Jacksonville, you know, where they win four games a year. So right. Like, you know, if you get it going, it's worth it staying in college.
Makes sense. Okay. A couple of games, wildcard weekend that I want to talk to you about. Start with the Ravens Titans, and the Ravens, of course, blazing into the playoffs, and offensively they are looking really in sync. But is that a little bit deceptive, Jeremy? When you look at the last five games, they've averaged over 37 points and they're tearing up defenses, but those defenses are the Cowboys, the Bengals, the Jags, the Giants, and Cleveland, the only playoff team in that five game stretch. So are we getting a little bit carried away with Baltimore reversing a season that was kind of in free fall really midway through, or should we be taking them seriously?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. Lamar Jackson's played better. There's no question about it. He's on a tear right now, but you have to account for the defenses they played. It's the same with the Chicago Bears. They were playing better under Mitch Trubisky, but they were also playing inferior opponents. Played the Packers at the end of the year, didn't put up as many points. You know, it's just
right.
It's that time of year now where Lamar Jackson is going to have to earn those tough yards from the pocket. But Tennessee is probably the perfect opponent for them right now because of their struggles in the secondary. I mean, they just can't cover right now. They don't have enough pass rush to help out. And, you know, they've been depleted in the secondary. So I don't know how Lamar Jackson doesn't have a big game, especially with his two playoff game struggles the last few years. He's going to want to go out there and make it happen. You know, as long as he can get his easy yards running the ball when the pocket does collapse, he should have a good day.
Yeah, because obviously they're both going to lean heavily on the ground game. But I guess that if the respective defenses of Baltimore's is stronger, as you say, is able to neutralize that to a degree, and I'm not quite sure what the definition of neutralizing Derrick Henry is, but if Baltimore's run game is neutralized, there just seems to be more, and maybe it's because of the versatility of Lamar and the lack of bite that the Tennessee defense has, there just seems to be more variation and range for Baltimore if that indeed happens. This stat blew my mind, Jeremy, that the Titans, and this alludes to your point about pass rush, I guess, the Titans 51.9% they're allowing third down conversions, which is the worst in NFL history. Well, okay, since modern NFL history, you know, the last 30 wow. plus years. Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. Mike Vrabel is, by all accounts, a really capable coach. He is obviously a defensively minded coach. Why is this defense so bad? Is it simply down to lightweight personnel, and they let too many, I mean, Jurrell Casey going seemed to be something they might live to regret. I mean, what has gone so horribly wrong with the Tennessee defense?
Yeah, I point to personnel and most specifically the pass rush. You get rid of Jurrell Casey, but then you sign Jadeveon Clowney and Vic Beasley. And they spent good money on those players, one-year deals, but they gave them, you know, almost $30 million combined in the whole package, and both were a disaster. I mean, Clowney got hurt too, you know, so it's hard to call that a disaster. It's not all his fault, but zero sacks in the games he played. He was one of the most coveted free agents and waited out all summer, finally signed with Tennessee. It was a big deal. They got nothing out of it. Vic Beasley couldn't see the field, had problems even showing up the training camp. And so when you were counting on those players up front, really Jeffrey Simmons is the only guy who's sort of that blue chip up front that can try to dominate a game. And so you just don't have enough. And so, you know, so much of being able to cover teams and stop teams on third down and seven in the passing game is just to have a good pass rush. You look at Pittsburgh. That's why Pittsburgh can make a run in the next few weeks, is because of that pass rush. If you don't have it, everything falls apart.
Yeah. Just one more on this one, and then we'll talk Steelers Cleveland before we let you go. Lamar, as you say, going to be motivated. That's inevitably the overwhelming narrative going into this, that he's 0-2 in the playoffs and look what happened last year and he can't throw the ball. Is there a danger that if it doesn't go Baltimore's way and Tennessee get the win, that this becomes one of those things like Romo style, that he can't win a playoff game and the momentum builds and it starts to become self-perpetuating as a result? In other words, there is a line at which if you continue to lose something, even if it isn't true at the moment that he's not capable of being a good playoff quarterback or an effective playoff quarterback, that at some point that gains so much momentum that it starts to affect the future.
It could, but I do think that Baltimore, from my understanding, that, you know, Baltimore looks at Lamar Jackson as wholly capable of handling that sort of adversity. Like, he wouldn't break under that pressure, even if they did lose. You know, they feel like he would come back stronger. He's got a lot of courage. That's a word that's been used to just talking to NFL personnel when they compare Lamar to, say, you know, some other quarterbacks that are younger. They're like, Lamar, you know, he's such a gamer. Mm. He's got courage. He doesn't shy away from the big moment. You know, so if he struggles, it's simply because, you know, he didn't make the throws or wasn't accurate enough. But, you know, game on the line, you want, you know, you like your chances with Lamar. Mm. And so they think it's just a matter of when he breaks through, not if. And so, but this year, I think the way they're playing and they're getting healthier on defense, you know, this is a team that entered the year as a Super Bowl contender, didn't show it. But now I think they're back to that form. Probably one of the most dangerous teams in the AFC.
Yeah. Really interesting to hear that about Lamar. I guess slightly different perspective with Baker Mayfield, at least the public perception. And I know he's rehabilitated that a lot this year, and he's been increasingly looking very capable on the field. And Stefanski clearly has a lot to do with that. But is there the risk that, irrespective of the COVID challenges they've got going into the game against the Steelers, that there is a fear that Mayfield is still too erratic, and particularly in a situation like this, he doesn't necessarily have the psyche to deal with the pressure?
I think they just need to rely on the system that they've had, and that when you have Nick Chubb, Kareem Hunt, and that running game, milk that and let Baker do the rest. So the more they simplify it, the better they're going to be. You know, they don't need to have Baker throw the ball 50 times just because the head coach is out and one of their linemen are out. You know, I think they can weather that. you know, really the only rough moment Baker's had recently was that Jets game, but he was missing his top four receivers.
And two linemen as well there, right? Right.
Yeah. So, you know, by and large, the season's been a huge success, whether he struggles this weekend or not. So, you know, I think they're in a good place with him. And, you know, this is – you talk to other people around the league, they say, look, the Browns have the best running game in the league where a lot of quarterbacks could thrive in that system.
Right.
That's not to discredit Baker, but it's just what they have going. They're creating good passing windows for him to throw in. So, and Baker has capitalized on that, you know, so they're pleased with him. I think they just figure he's going to go out and do what he's been doing all year, and they'll just rely heavily on Chubb and Hunt.
Will Bitonio out affect that? Because, you know, you mentioned the Jets game, and the logic when all those receivers went down was, well, they're just going to get Chubb and Hunt running, but because they were banged up on the line then as well, they couldn't do that. How much of an impact is that going to be in terms of establishing the ground game?
Well, it's big because of who you're playing. You know, Pittsburgh, they have Cam Hayward, Stephon Tuitt, two guys inside that are really good pass rushers, really strong. And so they need Bitonio to help with that. So that's going to be the issue, more the interior pass rush. But this is a good offensive line, and they should be getting Wyatt Teller back, who's been out. He's a good guard. So, you know, they're in position to still play well. You know, Bitonio's a very good player, but, you know, he's not you know, he's not going to dominate the game by himself. So that they feel good about their plan. I don't think they're going to change much.
In terms of the Steelers, were you surprised they rested Ben in week 17, given, look, I understand the logic. We all understand the logic. He's taken a lot. He's got a lot of miles in the on the clock, hasn't he? And taken a lot of hits over the years. And there was nothing really needed from the Steelers in that game. The flip side of that is the offense has been so out of rhythm, so out of sync, other than the second half of the Colts game, that it might be counterproductive, might prove to be counterproductive. Or is that a crazy line of thinking when you look at a quarterback as experienced as Roethlisberger?
Yeah, I think that's what they're relying on is just Big Ben's done this so many times, and they've rested him in the past, and he's still played okay in the playoffs. You know, they've had situations where they either had the bye wrapped up or their playoff seeding was finalized, you know, so Mason Rudolph playing well for them, I think, was a good change of pace going into the postseason, because they got the deep ball going a little bit more with a younger quarterback. I don't wonder if that gets Ben on even more of an edge this week. Like, hey, okay, you know, you got this other guy playing my role for a week and played pretty well. I'm going to come back and remind everybody what I can do. You know, he's probably above that and isn't thinking along those lines, but, you know, subconsciously there might be something there. And so,
I think it
actually created some positive momentum for the offense, actually. You know, it reminded them again that they're capable of stretching the field, you know. So, but they have to be able to run the ball a little bit. It's been so, at times, pathetic the way they can't run the ball. And they know it. And it's been hard for them to figure that out.
Is that ultimately going to be their Achilles heel, that in terms of a deep playoff run, that if they can't somehow work that out? They haven't all season long, pretty much, but assuming James Conner stays fit, I mean, if they can get something going there, just some kind of upside, then they're going to have a fighting chance. If they don't, then they're going to be too one-dimensional.
Yeah, just a thread of it. They don't need to run the ball 25 times a game to balance out 25 passes. It's not about that. It's just about showing a team you can at least do it when you need to. At times, they have not been able to do that at all. So you're relying solely on the short passing game, and teams are going to sit on that. So, you know, I think that to at least run the ball somewhat and be able to stretch the field with some vertical throws, even if you don't complete them all, just to try to keep the defense honest is going to be big for them, because, you know, their defense is going to keep them in every game.
Yeah, right. One more for you, Jeremy. Out of all the wildcard weekend games, which one are you looking forward to the most?
You know, I'm kind of psyched about the Rams-Seahawks game because of John Wolford. I like the way he played. He's just an intriguing storyline, assuming Jared Goff can't get back in time to play, coming off that thumb surgery. And so, you know, it'll probably be low scoring because Seattle's been playing that way. So I'm kind of curious when they let Russ cook it up a little bit versus when they go conservative. You know, because everybody, I'm sure you've heard that phrase, you know, let Russ cook, let Russell, you know, air it out. In the beginning of the season, they finally did that and everybody was excited. But I think you're seeing now they scaled it back because they feel like their identity is still pretty conservative. And that actually Russell Wilson is more of a conservative quarterback than you would think. Because, you know, the turnovers, like it's, you know, they know if they go too far, lean too hard on letting him air it out, they turn the ball over and they have a hard time controlling the game sometimes. So they scaled it back. I think it's probably going to be a little low scoring, so you're going to see some good defense. And I'm curious to see if the Rams can push them and pull that one out.
What the Rams saying, and McVay in particular, about Wolford, I mean, what's the kind of inside skinny there? Because they seem to be really big on him.
Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know if they were just trying to pump confidence in him or not, but I honestly think they like what they've seen, scouting him from the days he was playing semi-pro ball in the American Alliance League. And then now coming in, you know, he's a former potential Wall Street investor coming out of Wake Forest. Right, you know, he's right. Looking at getting a job off his LinkedIn page. But he's just, they like the way he can run their offense where, you know, you run the play action and you got to make quick decisions off that. They like the way he kind of processes information before the snap and after the snap. You hear that all the time of how important that is now more than ever for a quarterback. And he just kind of has a good knack for that.
And that's, of course, I guess a weak link for Jared Goff, right? You could say. So that is fascinating. I'm looking forward to that. We're going to get into that game in a bit with Tom Deacon, who's joining us shortly. Jeremy, really appreciate your time as ever, your insight. Thanks for dropping by.
Yeah, man, anytime. Happy New Year.
Lovely stuff from Jeremy. He'll be back soon. Really appreciate his insight. Finger on the pulse, no doubt about that. Let's get down to business and cover the other games we didn't get into with Jeremy, with our old friend and all-pro member of the NC Show, the brilliant Tom Deacon. Tom Deacon, always good to see you, particularly on the eve of Super Wild Card Weekend.
Never forget
the Super. Has it always been? It hasn't always been Super. I think it's this year that it has become Super. And you've made a super effort for us once again in terms of your background. So for all of our listeners who are checking out the pod but haven't gone onto our social channels at the NC Show, that's where the video lives: Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And why wouldn't you want to check those videos out when you can see the remarkable backdrop that Tom Deacon every time comes up with something new?
You're too kind, Nat. Yes, I've gone to the effort today with putting a Vernon Davis signed 49ers shirt. Why?
Where did he sign it? Whereabouts?
He signed it. I'll even bring it closer for the visuals. Nice. For the people just listening, it's not as good, but he signed it. And here's a little lesson. I folded it immediately after he signed it in permanent. So it's actually on the other side as well.
It's lodged. I like that.
Yeah, but I'm sure there's I'll Google it or YouTube it to find out how we can get rid of that. And on the other side, I've got a New Orleans Reggie Bush jersey, which I got from New Orleans when I went. But I make the effort now because, you know why? A few people online have said, why are you getting Tom Deacon on? And it's not just because we're mates, but also because I am, for the second time in a row, a Fantasy League winner. That is why I am on this podcast, because I bring the knowledge, the onions. You might not like what I say, but I say it truthfully and with facts, and I often say it with conviction. So it is great to be back.
To be fair, the only other person in the Fantasy League that you won was Adam Gase. So it was not exactly a high bar, right?
Everyone expected Adam Gase to take Frank Gore in the draft, and he did. So they were solid 8 or maybe 7 points each week. So
Frank Gore in the first round?
But here's the thing: now he's on the he's an option. I might contact him, get in contact with Adam Gase, and say, "Hey, next season Fantasy League, I need to hold on to this title.
Love that.
You got any tips?"
Well, just make him a co-owner. I like that idea. You're allowed to do that. I am a co-owner of my fantasy team with Olympic gold medalist Mark Hunter, who, as longtime listeners will know, famously drafted a tight end in the first round, who Ben Watson. He drafted George Kittle in the first round. It was Ben Watson.
Well, what caused most controversy was Le'Veon Bell went in, I think, pick number 7 this year in our draft, which, I mean, he was playing for the Jets. Anyway, listen, I don't want to get sidetracked with that.
Congratulations, course, anyway.
Yeah. Thank you very much. The Super Wild Card weekend.
Please don't forget that. We have covered a couple of games with Jeremy Fowler, and we've saved, all the good ones for you, Tom Deacon. So let's get straight down to it, because there's a ton to cover. I want to start with the Colts Bills, because I think it is one of the most games are hard to call. I think it's fair to say this weekend, one or two a bit more straightforward, but the Colts Bills amongst the hardest, because the Bills opened the week as heavy favorites, kind of touchdown favorites. And as producer Ollie was telling me on our Edge Rush show, which you can pick up. I think it's dropping late Friday, whenever you listen to this. So either before or after that, that'll kind of give you a mark if you want to listen to the Edge Rush show. That a lot of money coming in on the Colts. So that line is coming down. Now, there are a few reasons for that. Stephon Diggs, at the time of us recording this, Tom, Thursday afternoon, Stephon Diggs, Cole Beasley as well. Not clear cut in terms of fitness, right? They're injury concerns, which of course will have a significant impact if either miss out. And certainly if Diggs is missing, that's a massive blow. But Beasley too, an instrumental part of that offense. But the Bills, nevertheless, heavy favorites. And you can understand why, looking statistically right now at this offense, because it has been humming. I think it's fair to say second in the NFL in terms of total yards per game, second in the NFL total points per game, top six in yards per point, yards per play, for the best on third down conversion, average time of possession, number three in the league as well. They're absolutely bossing it. I mean, it's no doubt about it. They're one of the teams going into the NFL with momentum.
Yeah, Nat, totally on board with the Bills. When I look at where the money is lying in this game, unanimously, it's on the Bills. And good reason why. You know, the AFC East champs. And Josh Allen has been lights out, if not MVP contention. He's definitely been there or thereabouts all season. And he looks different. He looks like he can actually carry the Bills. But like you say, if Stephon Diggs doesn't play, if Cole Beasley, who's had his best ever stat season in the NFL, can't be there to take the field, then will they struggle? But then they looked incredible with their backups playing in their last game against the Miami Dolphins. They play to win. They play to throw that football. And they look fearless, which is not like the Bills that were in the playoffs last season.
Yeah, and a lot gets talked about that, doesn't it? The experience. I've often thought about this, not just specific to the NFL, but generally in sports, when you hear people talking about, well, they'll benefit from the experience of being there. Say if it's the Champions League and they go out in the last 16, and you think, what does that mean? And I think it is absolutely true in the NFL, certainly for a coach like Sean McDermott, certainly for a player like Josh Allen. It is inevitably going to be an altogether different proposition when you've got plenty under your belt. And that, of course, is the big angle as far as the Colts are concerned, right? Because you've got Rivers, who is one of the most experienced quarterbacks in the game right now. Of course, probably the best quarterback never to make it to a Super Bowl, certainly of his generation, and running out of time. But he is, if we're talking about the Bills absolutely humming, he is on point. And I think it's really gone under the radar. We've talked a bit about it on the show, Tom. I think a lot of it is a stylistic thing. I think increasingly in the generation that we live in, where highlights are instant, the NFL is getting more and more innovative offensively. We're seeing more and more players like Mahomes just changing the rule book in terms of what he's able to deliver. And so a slightly unreconstructed, old school, not particularly mobile, slinging vet like Rivers, who doesn't have the most gainly style in terms of passing either, I think does go under the radar. And if you look at the numbers here, he's had the third highest completion percentage of his career this season. He's thrown nine fewer picks than he did last year. He's obviously got a much better offensive line in front of him, which has helped both of those as well. And they've got a really good ground game rolling too. And I think that could be key here. The ground game of the Colts gaining edge up against one of the weak links as far as the Bills defense is concerned. The Bills, I guess in totality, their rush defense, they're ranked third worst in the NFL according to PFF in terms of their season grade run defense. So surely that is cause for optimism for the Colts.
Yeah, cause for optimism. I will be very positive about the Colts here. You're talking about Philip Rivers, the guy to never win a Super Bowl. Jacoby Brissett and him have done very well for the Colts this season. I love it watching him mic'd up. Philip Rivers is fantastic to watch. Let's go, D. Come on, home, D. He's really passionate, never swears, just really behind his team. So if you want a leader to lead and galvanize the team, great. Phillip Rivers is there for you. Yes, they've got that run game going with Taylor. He had, I think, a franchise for the Colts, a record, and his last matchup over 200 odd yards he ran for. So great. On the run game, looks tidy, looks good. Problem is for the Colts, they just can't complete enough on third down. I think that in terms of their percentage, it's not as good. When you look at the Bills, they've got one of the best third down conversion rates. So it's going to come down to that defense. Someone like DeForest Buckner for the Colts to rush and to put Josh Allen under pressure. Can he do it? As they always say in NFL, at these moments, these effort plays win games. And anything can happen, but I still would lean against the Bills. They're just too strong for this Colts team. And I'm trying to be optimistic about the Colts' chance, because anything we know, it's playoff football now. Forget about the regular season. That's done. This is knockout football now. So the Colts can, with Jacoby Brissett and Phillip Rivers, galvanize that team and get across the line. But they're going against, if not the outside chance of winning the Super Bowl, the Bills.
You know, I wonder on that hype around the Bills and the impact that that's going to have, if anything. And it's something that Ollie and I got into on Edge Rush. So head on over there if you want to listen to that in depth. But a kind of summary, and I'm keen to get your opinion on it. It's very different for the Bills this time out, because they're going into the playoffs now as, certainly amongst the favorites. The Chiefs are obviously the favorites, but this more and more, this narrative about, well, if any team's going to take down the Chiefs, it's going to be the Bills. Like they're very much the buzz team right now. And I wonder how that suits Buffalo.
Well, last time out in the playoffs last year, everyone said, should the Bills be there? How have they managed to get there? Josh Allen led that team, and he wasn't even the Josh Allen that we're giving all the plaudits and the credit to this season. So he carried that team. You've got the weapons in Stephon Diggs and Cole Beasley, who they're just singing from the same hymn sheet. They look great. The pressure is on them. So will they implode? I just doubt it. But I think that would be the only way they would lose this game against the Colts, if they stop believing in themselves, believe that hype, and something goes amiss. You know, an interception from Josh Allen, it's a pick six. We've seen that so many times with the Colts this year. That can change the dynamic of the game. Then the Colts start running the football. Bills don't have the ball. There's not enough time on the clock. Anything can happen, as we know. But I just think the Bills believe in themselves, and the way they dismantled Miami with all of their cornerbacks and how well they've been playing on defense all year, I just like them. Would they beat the Chiefs? I doubt that, but I'm liking these Bills, and they're the only ones that can beat them, I think.
Okay, let's go to the NFC for our next game. Rams, Seahawks, another keenly poised matchup, right? I think you're rubbing your San Francisco top because you've got two rivals here going head to head. It makes that pain even more acute. The 49ers aren't in there, so if you want to clutch onto it, Tom, for the whole of this particular game chat, feel free to do that.
I'm not going to sit on the fence. I'm not going to be talking about the Niners. I know I'm doing it right now, so that defeats what I've just said, but this is the only time I'm going to mention the Niners. Division rivals, and this game, and I look at it and think, if they've played each other once or twice this season already, and they've both won against each other. So if anyone knows each other, how they're going to play, it's this matchup. And I don't think this is going to be a pretty game. I think this is going to be real stuck in the trenches, sacks galore, nothing pretty about this game. That's all I'm going to say on it so far. Nat, please, you take over now, because I'm going to be unbiased.
You're spot on with, and certainly Vegas agrees with you, as the saying goes, the over-under is particularly low. I think people think this is going to be a low-scoring, defensively driven affair. And you could understand why, certainly as far as the Rams are concerned, it is, I would argue, the best defense in the NFL. I certainly think it's on that shortlist. And through the entire unit, you know, obviously that front seven, they're going to have Brockers back, which is a big plus there. That tag team of Jalen and Darius Williams has to be amongst the best corner tag team in the league right now. Jalen shut down DK Metcalf both times these guys played, and that is the benefit of having a shutdown corner like Jalen Ramsey. You can neutralize the biggest aerial threat there, and that is clearly an issue for Seattle, but much less so now, I think, than it would have been, or it was, 7-8 weeks ago, and certainly was at the start of the season, because their offensive game plan has changed. It's reverted to type. They've gone back to leading with the run, And they're a very different offensive outfit to the one we saw at the start of the season. So it's really, really intriguing, I think, whether Russell Wilson will be able to mix things up to the degree that we've seen him do and has had a huge amount of success, even when the overall offensive flow is breaking down a little bit, against a defense this good that is chiming as well as they are right now. You'd be insane to back against Russell Wilson, but this offensive line is in all kinds of disarray. And I think the Rams are going to have a lot of success there. There was a really interesting point made with by Mike Tannier, who's a brilliant writer. And it's something that we mentioned a bit on the Edge Rush show, really relevant, I think, to mention here in relation to this game. Looking at the specific matchups with regards to the way that Seattle set themselves up and rarely use a nickel and dime defense, right? And obviously as well with Adams blitzing more than any other safety in the league, that puts a lot of pressure on one of their rookie linebackers. Seattle's rookie linebacker is called Jordan Brooks. And the point Tanier is making is that that is a mess when you're up against a Sean McVay style offense, right? That can really, really leverage that mismatch, particularly with Cooper Kupp, who should be back. So I think that's going to be fascinating as well from on the other side of the ball, this improving and emerging Seahawks defense, whether they just don't sit well, a match up well against the Rams. Now, of course, the one major thing that we haven't got into yet is the Jared Goff situation. Goff, at the time of recording, unclear if he's going to start or not, which means that John Wolford might be getting a second start. What do you make of his debut?
I can't put my thumb on it. See what I did there, Nat? Because nice. Jared Goff, thumb injury. Yeah, nice. I take on board everything you've just said. And I think our listeners will be looking at this, not knowing who, if you were to bet on a team and say, I think this team has got it. Because the Seahawks they've been sort of Jekyll and Hyde. One minute they were this explosive offense. We thought Russell Wilson, MVP candidate. How good is Russell Wilson? And then that sort of eased off and the defense has completely taken over all of the sort of efforts of that Seahawks team. Mm. And the Rams, brilliant on defense. Fantastic. I totally agree with you. The number one defense in the league right now. So what does it come down to? Is it going to purely come down to this game? Who can be the better quarterback? Who can roll that offense? Because defensively, you need to play lights out to beat these better defenses that you're going up against. And Russell Wilson, you know, how many times is he going to be sacked? But he resurrects like the Day of the Dead. He just keeps getting back up again. and
he's the Undertaker of NFL quarterbacks.
Yeah, I mean, because he's just remarkable how you can't hurt Russell Wilson. He just keeps getting up and keeps going at you. But I look at this and I think the Rams have got a better chance of winning without Jared Goff. And I know that might be seen as controversial, as a little bit left field, but Wolford's got it all to do, but he's got no pressure on his back. Jared Goff has not played well this season. He's done just enough, a couple of bootlegs here, left, right, and center. And I feel like if he just plays with a bit of confidence and like, I've got nothing to lose here, a couple of deep balls will do the Seahawks. So I actually think the Rams can take this game because I don't like the way that the offense is going for the Seahawks. But you, again, of any quarterback, you can't write off Russell Wilson. So this is why it's so close as a game.
It's a great point you make, you know, particularly with Goff's obvious problem against pressure, right? And it's a point we often, I think, need to emphasize on the show, because I just hear so many pundits say, well, you know, he's not great under pressure. And it's like, well, can you give me any quarterback that thrives under pressure? But well, Russell Wilson seems to, and Deshaun Watson, you know, they're kind of exceptions to the rule, but every quarterback regresses, some more than others, right? And Goff is the poster boy for that, really. And this is where the Seahawks are making hay at the moment defensively, is their pass rush. That is how they've started to reclaim some of that identity that we would typically associate with a Pete Carroll defense, right? And Adams is brilliant in that respect. And the gamble, I guess, with you having him blitz so much, Mike Tannier, you know, brilliantly explained that you leave issues underneath, and that is where a McVay-style offense, when in rhythm, can really carve you up and just, as our friend O.C. Umanuro would say, death by a thousand cuts. So it is intriguing. If Goff plays, and they get in his face, I think that's an issue for the Rams. And in many respects, Wolford's the better bet there because he's more mobile, as he demonstrated in the first game.
And also the tape's not there.
The
Seahawks know how to play Jared Goff,
right?
Smack him in the mouth and he'll begin to panic. Now I'm not, and you're quite right to say that about quarterbacks. Everyone, no one likes being punched in the face, but in terms of a quarterback getting up again, you need someone to be fearless in this matchup. And the likes of Carlos Dunlap running at you, carving up another sack, it must be terrifying. And the way that the Seahawks line up, you know, there'll be maybe 5-6 players just running at you, especially Adams as well. You know, it's going to require McVay to think outside the box, come up with all these special plays to try and carve up the Seahawks. And they're there for the taking at times.
Where are you in terms of Carroll and McVay? Who'd you be? Tom Deacon has dropped 3 passes in the first half and you're sitting there by your locker and you're just waiting and you hear the footsteps. And who are you more worried about facing?
I'd immediately tell whoever head coach I decide in a second that I'm injured and I can't play on.
The Randy Bullock. Do you remember earlier in the season when Bullock missed that kick and then just held his hammy straight away? Like, that's why. That's why I missed the kick. Would you blame your receiver as well? Would you put it on? Do we just a little whisper in his ear like, Nat, I just want to say, coach, that was Nat. That was on that.
Yeah. Oh, you would do it very, very quietly and away from all cameras and make sure you're not mic'd up. Definitely. Mm. I might just say, I think I did tell him the other route, but listen, forget about it. Let's just focus on the next play. Pete Carroll, if he's got the gum, if he's not chewing gum, I'd be more fearful of him because you're like, he is teething, that guy.
Yeah, right.
He wants to go into you. But then Sean McVay sometimes this is his eyes. It looks like a puppy dog. You'd feel more emotionally broke up. It's like when your parents say, I'm disappointed in you. That cuts deep.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not the shouting. Maybe McVay and what happened in the Super Bowl against the Patriots. I'd be more mentally broken by McVay coming in and just giving me that emotional bombardment.
We were getting into that McVay, and I apologize, I can't remember who was talking to me about this on the show the other week, but how McVay is one of those coaches that just seems to be, it might have even been Greg Brady, but who just seems to be encouraging his team and particularly Goff, even when he's stinking the joint out. And I like that. I really like that about McVay, that, you know, I reckon that game that Nate Peterman threw, whatever it was, 6 interceptions, McVay would be, come on, Nate, you got this.
Yeah, you're breaking me here, man. Come on. Like watching him in Hard Knocks and you're like, I really like McVay. And this is the thing, whatever team you support, you can applaud greatness. And when people are able to lift their team and man management and coaching, when it's at the top, you have to take your hat off. You have to say that I like that. And I do like Sean McVay. And Pete Carroll has been there, done it. He's like an old dog that just will not go down. I feel like McVay is the future of the NFL. And emotionally, he would blackmail you worse.
It's going to be great watching those two go head to head as well. A brilliant offensive mind, a brilliant defensive mind, and really, really close game. Less so with the next two games, I think, but maybe you'll beg to differ. So the Bucs taking on Washington, in Washington, of course, because they are the divisional winners, so they get the home field advantage. Really interesting going into this week, into this game. This week, Chase Young calling out Tom Brady. I love this. I want Tom. It was his declaration. And Brady's been quite effusive and offsetting it. Old pro that he is. Brady said in response to Young, baring his teeth, he's obviously a great young player and we have our hands full with that defensive line. Well, that's absolutely true. You've got as well as young Montez Sweat and Daron Payne, Jonathan Allen. It's a heavyweight crew. And that is, we know, Tom, is the book on getting to Brady, right? I mean, you get in Brady's face up the middle in particular and suddenly everything unravels, or at least it can. In the past, that's how teams have taken down the great Brady. So does that give you cause for optimism that the Washington football team have got at least a fighting chance in this game?
As I said earlier, Nat, I think this is just 60 minutes of football. as we know, anything could happen. And I'm not going to sit on the fence with my answer. Yes, Washington can deliver on defensively with that pressure that they have up front. And if you get in Tom Brady's grill, he's not the most mobile quarterback, although he has improved the Bucs, it seems to be so. They can protect him more than any offensive line can, and the amount of, least amount of times he's been sacked. So Brady is well protected, but Chase Young, that's a different mentality when you've got that coming at you, and Montez Sweat. But I just don't see it. And also, I don't dislike Chase Young for saying that, because you want to play the best. That's what we love about NFL.
Do you think it's a mistake?
No, I don't think it's... I mean, Tom Brady's been there and done that. The most amount of playoff wins as any quarterback leading his team. But Chase Young, I like that idea. We don't want the weakest team. We don't want to have the playoffs an easier run. Chase Young's like, yeah, bring on Brady. I'm ready. Yeah. And he was skipping. Good Morning Football highlighted it. You can't dislike a man who's skipping while he's saying, bring on Brady.
You mean skipping as in Rocky boxing skipping, as opposed to... No, he was skipping along.
Joyfully skipping off the field in what was a very, very ugly game against the Eagles. But I like that passion. I like that commitment. Chase Young believes in himself. Mm. So yes, when they go up there, he's going to be fearless, but he is taking on an offensive line that have been able to protect Tom Brady. What makes Chase Young feel that he can do something differently that other defensive ends have not been able to do all season? So I like that. I like that confidence. But if they do and are successful defensively, Washington, offensively, what are they able to muster? Everyone's banged up. I love Alex Smith. If you've not watched the ESPN 30 for 30, his recovery, the man almost lost his leg, not just came back to play. He almost lost his leg. It is a very touching documentary. It's beautiful. Mm. He's done what he had. He is a warrior, a champ for getting back there. Mm. But statistically, you look at that, they've got a chance if they have Henneke, their backup quarterback in. I think they would have a better chance. Terry McLaurin, a little bit banged up. Antonio Gibson running the football, banged up. You know, Logan
Where
Thomas
are the points coming from? They're talking about that, aren't they? That it's you're spot on about Alex Smith, and clearly a lock for comeback player of the year, right? But they're talking about maybe interchanging Henneke and Alex Smith, which we're seeing more and more, of course. I mean, the obvious examples there are when Taysom Hill comes in for the Saints, Jacoby Brissett, you mentioned earlier on, we see him in for Rivers, obviously Fitz and Tua is a slightly different situation there, but it is happening increasingly. And this, I think they're talking about taking it to next level, where you're going to have a more equal balance of snaps between quarterback. Now, this is just rumbling at the moment, and Ron Rivera and the Washington organization are not knocking that back. And that could be mind games, of course, going into the playoffs and getting the Bucs to think, well, maybe they're going to be doing this, or how often, and getting them thinking about it. But that would be really interesting. And I wonder if that's going to be something that we see more and more continue to increase, that there is a progressive approach to either bringing quarterbacks as closers, kind of like how the Finns have a little bit. In certain situations, of course, it makes huge sense, and that's how the Saints use Taysom Hill. But I'm talking about more steadily, more interchanging, a more even balance of snaps. So that's going to be fascinating to watch. We rightly celebrate the Washington front seven, but this Tampa Bay front seven's pretty decent as well, right? I mean, 47 sacks, actually one more than Washington this season. They're both top six teams in terms of sacks. It's a decent defense, a decently balanced side, the way the offense is rolling now as well. If we think the Bills, Tom, the team that are timing things right and are the most rounded to challenge the Chiefs in the AFC, are people sleeping a little bit on the Bucs here, the way that they've suddenly seemingly turned the corner offensively and are blowing teams away? The final four games of the season, Brady has completed 69% of his passes, 1,300 plus yards, 12 touchdowns and one pick. So are we maybe sleeping a little bit on the Bucs? Are they the team that could... I mean, look, it's more competitive, I think it's fair to say, in the NFC, but and maybe more open as a result of that. But everyone's talking up the Packers, the Saints. Not many people talk about the Bucs as serious Super Bowl contenders.
No, and if they want to go via your thought of seeing more like Jalen Hurts and Sudfield stepping up, that yes, that could happen. Blaine Gabbert, I do not think will be coming in for a couple of snaps over Tom Brady. But yes, I don't think it's we're sleeping on the Bucks. I think our pessimistic British attitude a lot of the time is we don't want them to do well because, oh, wouldn't that be like so fitting for Tom Brady? So we've been kind of reluctant to believe in them. Mm. When they got taken apart by the Saints earlier on in the season, we were like, ah, oh, see, told you. But they would have learned from that. When we were saying cynically, Bruce Arians and this Tom Brady relationship, that just can't work out. It's not sustainable.
Right.
Arians is asking Brady to throw the deep ball. Well, guess what? They have had all those games to learn. There was no preseason. Let's not forget. So they are rolling now. And defensively, you're quite right to point out Jason Pierre-Paul, Devin White, you've got Shaquille Barrett, 48 sacks there. They're a weapon. Ndamukong and Sue is in that lineup as well. And offensively, Godwin, Mike Evans, I thought, oh no, he's hyperextended his knee. He's absolutely fine. And so is Antonio Brown. They're a weapon. And with their run game with Leonard Fournette and Ronald Jones, they're the complete package. And the fact that you've got Tom Brady, who knows the playoffs better than anybody else, I don't think it's we're sleeping on them. We just didn't want them to be as successful as they potentially could be.
I think the ground game could be key in this as well to counter and deflect that pressure and pass rush from Washington. Just let Fournette and Jones grind him down. It really wouldn't surprise me if they lead with that. And the deep ball is one of my favorite narratives of the season. All of the talking, Brady just doesn't have the deep ball anymore. And then you just see an absolute bomb getting Scotty Miller or whoever it is. And writing off Brady is, I mean, for God's sake, have you not learned this? It's probably not a good idea.
And also, people talk about, his arm. It's not as strong as it was. It's not as accurate. Well, he was thrown in Tampa. It was fine. Yeah. Conditions were perfect for Brady. And that whole argument about the deep ball and Arians and them not getting on, people strive with a bit of adversity. So we've actually, again, it's like the Patriots. We hated on them and they kept winning. When are we as fans going to learn? We should say the Bucks are going to do really well. They're going to go all the way. And with Gronk as well in there as a weapon. Right. And Tom Brady's just got comfort blanket after comfort blanket around him. But the Redskins, I do apologize, the Washington football team have got a situation where they can't throw the ball that far with Alex Smith. It's dink and dunk. It's not going to be enough to get from one end down to the other if the Bucks are able to run the football and run the clock down.
I love that's a great point. I think this is going to be relatively straightforward for Tampa Bay. I love that other narrative as well. He's got too many weapons, Tom Brady. What? What does that mean? He's got too many elite players around him, of course. Bears Saints seems to be another mismatch, and certainly Vegas agrees with that as well. The Saints almost double-digit favorites for this. Looks like Alvin Kamara will be back. Michael Thomas, we think, but the Saints have been fine for much of the season without Thomas. The Saints, and this is the book on the Saints, right? That you can remove Thomas, you can take Drew Brees out of the mix, you can take your entire running back core out of the mix, and they're still able to put up points. And when you balance that with the defense that they've got, which is really starting to get in motion right in time for the playoffs, formidable team going into the postseason, and surely up against Trubisky and co, not even a fair fight.
No, definitely not. And when you asked me the question earlier about the Bills, have they as a team, when you come to the playoffs, had enough ups and downs in the season and learned from them? The Saints have definitely done that. When they previously played the Bears earlier in the season, the defense wasn't quite where it is now. They've gone through the whole Drew Brees, Taysom Hill changing back and forth, not having any running backs. Ty Montgomery, yes, please. Yeah, if you just come on through. I know you started as a wide receiver. Could you just play as running back now? They've been through every up and down this season, and that's why they're for me the sort of kind of dark horse that is really coming into this end of season games that you can't go against them. Drew Brees, you know, yes, Father Time is against him, but he's looked better as the season's gone on. Mm-hmm. Kamara, I mean, wow, what a player he is. And I just think that Michael Thomas doesn't even need to be fully fit, but as long as he's on the field, he's a worry and a concern for the Bears. And then you've got Emmanuel Sanders there to be able to deliver as well. Mm. The Saints are just turning up the heat exactly when they need to. And I'd be concerned if I was a Bears fan.
Something's just occurred to me, and this is the point where our listeners are all in unison spitting out tea or coffee and saying, this has only just occurred to you, but you've got Rodgers, Brady, Breeze, Roethlisberger, Alex Smith. They're all in the playoffs.
Yeah.
What's that? You know, I mean, it's, you know, veteran central, right? Rivers. Yeah. I mean, it's incredible.
And on the stats, looking at Philip Rivers, he's there, like the all-time numbers he's put up. Same with Aaron Rodgers. They're there year after year. As much as we like, oh, I'm really excited about this player coming through the draft, and I think this guy's got it. It takes time to become an elite quarterback if you're given the opportunities and you've got enough raw talent and you're able to deal with the adversities that come your way. They're the ones that are going to keep coming back, and they drive that team. There's something to be said about a quarterback being a leader. And if you've been there, done it before, new players coming through look up to that quarterback. And that's why the likes of Drew Brees is there. And Taysom Hill is learning off one of the best. So
yeah,
it's a real concern. And on the flip side of it, and you know, what do I do in when regular season is over with my team no longer in it? I look at free agency. Nah, that's what I do. I look at where my team can go shopping. And when I look at the fact that Mitch Trubisky is going to be a free agent, he is definitely in the shop window for a team that needs a backup. So I feel
how depressed would you be? Yeah, all this talk of the 49ers gutting for a new quarterback, all these names that are being associated, and then the big new signing that's unveiled is Mitch Trubisky.
I have been watching, being forced to, and also enjoying Bridgerton. So I'm going to say the phrase, you wound me, sir, with that comment of Mitch Trubisky turning up at the Niners, who the Bears traded with the Niners to get him in the draft, to move up one place. No, thank you. Even though the Niners are only going to have Jimmy Garoppolo on their books, it is the year for quarterbacks. No, Philip Rivers, he's on a free agent next year. So is Jacoby Brissett. This is the final chance for that Bears team to sort of, I don't know, see whether Trubisky can do it. I think when you look at these two quarterbacks, Drew Brees, it's kind of like, how do you feel? Do you feel up to making that play? Do you feel confident with your body? Okay, we'll trust you. Mitch, just do what we say. There's the difference. And I'm trying not to be disrespectful, but I'm being honest. I'm just saying.
Yeah, sure.
Their run game for the Bears could get them across the line. And again, someone like Allen Robinson, another guy, free agent at the end of the year, it's his time to shine. And will the Bears defense maybe get a turnover? That's what could turn this game on its head. It's Trubisky versus Breeze. Breeze has got this. I'm sorry.
It's not a fair fight. Cracking stuff, Tom. It's always brilliant to catch up with you. What's next for you? What are you up to at the moment?
Well, I'm looking at the free agent kickers at the moment.
Nice.
And a lot of teams, if there's a guy out there, the Bears kicker, Santos, most accurate in the NFL this year. He's a free agent. Sign him up. In all honesty, it's getting ready for F1 Esports again when that comes back. Virtual Grand Prix, that might happen. I don't want to give too much away. And it's waiting for live comedy to come back, Nat. So there you go. That is me in a nutshell.
It's always good to catch up with you, bud.
Pleasure.
Listeners can follow you on Twitter, Instagram, Tom H. Deacon.
Yes, and on Instagram, just to mix it up a little bit, I'm Tom Deacon Comedy. There's not a lot of comedy. There's mainly presenting. But get me in the trades description act. Sue me if you want.
Legendary stuff, bud. Good to catch up. See you soon.
Take care now.
Lovely stuff from Tom. He'll be back very soon. You can count on that. We will be back very soon as well. Check out the Edge Rush show with me and producer Ollie. That is dropping Saturday morning, maybe even late Friday, led to believe, of course, because you've got the Saturday game. So it might be dropping a little bit earlier this week. And then Jay Bell back on the show. Looking forward to catching up with him on Monday, reviewing all the action from what is undoubtedly going to be a compelling wildcard weekend. So make sure you're locked in for that final thing. Big shout out to all of you who have left a review on whichever platform you listen to us on. We massively appreciate that. Some really, really nice reviews cropping up. Seen a plenty on iTunes. So massive thanks for that. Wherever you're listening to us, even if you got 30 seconds, drop a review. It helps us out, helps out ESPN, our sponsors. And most importantly, puts a big smile on producer Ollie and producer Marley's face, which keeps us all very, very happy and in check. Appreciate that. Enjoy the wildcard weekend. Don't forget Edge Rush, and we'll see you on Monday with Jay Bell. Bye for now.